This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programmes or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on Newstalk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. And in tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of C.S. Lewis. And we'll be finding out how a shy academic from Belfast created the world of Narnia and brought us The Lion, The Witch and The Wardrobe. Then in the second hour, we'll be hearing about the sexual humiliation of prisoners in Nazi concentration camps as we review a history of sexuality in the 20th century. We'll be remembering our war dead when we talk to Shane McTamosh about Glasnevin Cemetery and the men and women buried there. We'll be finding out what James Joyce got up to in Paris and whether Dublin remained his spiritual home. We'll be learning about gallows, garrisons and gutter snipes and the part they played in the rich history of Galway. And then to end the show, we'll be investigating the extraordinary story of a Roman legion which ended up in China and which is now proving a massive tourist attraction. Don't forget, if you want to comment on any of our items, you can text the show at any time on 53106. That's for 30 cent. You can call us on our low-call 8090 number, 453106, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.ie. Last week, we debated the history of the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879, and we looked at how it brought an end to the independent Zulu kingdom in a shocking display of British imperialism. It was a very lively debate, and if you want to listen back to that or some of our older shows, just go to the website. newstalk.ie, or you can download the show as a podcast on iTunes. Just download iTunes or go to iTunes and you'll find the show there. In tonight's debate, we're looking at the life and legacy of C.S. Lewis. Born Clive Staples Lewis in Belfast on the 29th of November 1898, though known as Jack from the age of four, he fought as a young man in the First World War and was wounded at the Battle of Arras in April 1918. After the war, he moved in with the mother of a dead friend, having promised that he would look after her, and there has been much speculation about the exact nature of this relationship. Completing his degree at Oxford, Lewis was elected a fellow and tutor at Magdalen College, Oxford, a post he held for nearly 30 years. It was in his Magdalen rooms that a few friends, known as the Inklings, met weekly in the 1930s, a group which included J.R.R. Tolkien. Although he became internationally well known because of his writings, for example The Allegory of Love in 1936, Lewis is now primarily remembered for the seven fantasy novels he wrote between 1950 and 1956, the Chronicles of Narnia series. Although criticised for being Christian allegories or philosophical fairy tales, they have remained hugely popular with children and three were recently adapted for film. In April 1956, he married Joy Gresham, a divorced American woman with whom he had been corresponding since 1950, but she died of cancer in 1960. This relationship was later explored in the stage play and film Shadowlands. Lewis died of a heart attack on the 22nd of November 1963 and was buried at Oxford. It has been said that admiration in the United States for Lewis's Christian writings eventually reached the level of a cult, while more recent studies have looked at his sexuality and his troubled relationship with his father. To celebrate the centenary of his birth, in 1998 a statue was erected on the Newtownards Road in Belfast depicting Lewis entering a wardrobe. And in fact, if you just Google C.S. Lewis statue Newtownards Road, you'll find that, and it's a superb statue. It's a superb representation and tribute to his life. So in tonight's show, we want to ask, how good a writer was Lewis, and is there more to him than the Chronicles of Narnia? Well, to help me assess his life and his legacy, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Bruce L. Edwards is Professor of English at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, in the United States, and was the general editor of the recently published four-volume series C.S. Lewis, Life, Works and Legacy, published by Prager Perspectives in 2007. He is also the author of four separate works on Lewis, including Not a Tame Line and Further Up and Further In, Understanding C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Jude Collins is a former lecturer at the University of Ulster and is now a writer and broadcaster and blogs at www.judecollins.net. Like C.S. Lewis, Dr. Conor Costick is a novelist, academic and medievalist. He lectures in the Department of History at Trinity College Dublin and is the author of a best-selling trilogy of science fiction and fantasy novels for young adults. And in fact, he's just this week been shortlisted for the most prestigious prize in children's literature, the Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award. And we wish him the very best of luck with that, especially because there seems to be a rather large cash prize associated with that. And we may get a drink out of him or some evening celebration if he wins. But he certainly deserves to. Well, all my guests, you're all very welcome. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Father Pat Rogers, a biblical theologian with an interest in literature at the Milltown Institute, and he's based in Mount Argus. But Bruce, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
And maybe we might start off then by talking about the early life of C.S. Lewis. Is it true that he took the name Jack at the age of four when his dog died? Is it true that he wasn't particularly close to his father, that when he was sent to be educated in England, he compared it later to a Nazi concentration camp? And that is it true that I suppose he had quite, I suppose, a difficult early life?
Well, I cannot verify that the name Jackson comes from a dog that passed away. I've not heard that one before, but certainly he did refer to himself as Jackson, and I think it represents an early imaginative leap of his that I think is characteristic of the rest of his life. I think most biographers, and including Lewis himself, would say that his first 9 years were kind of idyllic, growing up in Belfast, and though maybe not especially close to his father, probably had a typical relationship with fathers who worked outside the home, very close to his mother. And I think there's considerable consensus that the loss of his mother to cancer when he was nine created a wedge in the family household, and a sense of, if not alienation, a kind of an abandonment by Albert, his father. And it's certainly true that Lewis's years in various boarding schools over the next 10 years were tremendously impactful in a very kind of troubled imaginative life, as well as struggling with not only the loss of his mother, but even the distance from his brother, with whom he was very close.
And Jude, when we look at I suppose the joining up at the British Army, fighting in the First World War, suffering from trench fever and being wounded, that must have had an extraordinary influence on I suppose the development of him as a thinker, as a person, as a writer, in every way.
Well, it's impossible to think it wouldn't. Anybody, I think I saw somebody in RTE tonight who said everybody who came back from the First World War was wounded in one way or another. So, of course, the experiences he had in the First World War would have affected him deeply. But I was rereading his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, and it's surprising how little space he gives to the First World War. He talks about the companionship between himself and some of the other soldiers. He talks about the books that he read when he was there. And then we're back to Oxford, and he talks about life at Oxford almost with more interest than he does about his time fighting as a soldier in the First World War. Now, he does describe it briefly with great vividness. He talks about men being injured and almost like a half-squashed insect lying there and dying. So the brief glimpse he gives you, certainly in this, in Surprised by Joy, the book, the autobiography Surprised by Joy, the little glimpse he gives you is quite a vivid and horrifying one. But again, he doesn't spend that long with that part of his life. He moves rapidly on again to when coming back to Oxford and what that's like, and the various people he met and so on. He also spends a lot of time talking about his years as a boy, as you've, I think it was Bruce said. He seems to, whether he was repressing the memory of the First World War or whether it was that he genuinely felt his life began after the First World War, it's not absolutely clear. But the impression I got was that if it wounded him, it was something that he internalized and doesn't speak about too much in his writings.
And Bruce, I suppose on this show we really want to assess his whole life, his legacy, and not really get involved in too much speculation about things maybe connected to his private life. But there has been an awful lot of interest in that relationship with Jane Moore, the mother of the friend who died in the First World War. He had made a promise to look after his family the same, and I think they had made a promise that if one of them died, the other would look after the other family. But some of his biographers have focused on that and thought that maybe there was a sexual element to the relationship as well, and I think certainly Jane Moore's own daughter thought that.
Well, I think in referring to Surprised by Joy, there are a number of the ellipses in Lewis's life, and that's certainly one of them, and there's very little detail provided there, and you know, it's scattered references in Lewis's private letters to friends like Arthur Greaves and even his own father. I think whatever occurred there, and however we speculate about it, the fact is, from Lewis's point of view, anything that would have been considered inappropriate certainly ended after his conversion. And I think in thinking of Lewis's autobiography, as well as the snippets of his life that he reveals through his books and in his letters, he considers that kind of a closed chapter. I think that's also the reason there's very little about World War One there. And Surprised by Joy is really an autobiography of a conversion, even more than it is a survey of his life.
And Bruce, why do you think he went from being raised in a devout Church of Ireland family to becoming an atheist, having all of these struggles, and then deciding to become a high church Anglican? What was the process involved there?
Well, I don't think there's any process. I think Lewis was someone who felt that one's religious obligations should be carried out where he lives. And I think he thought of this as sort of a transfer of membership from a church that he was certainly born into and baptized into to just a different location. And because of Lewis's convictions about being a mere Christian, I think that was kind of a steady theme to his life, that he should practice his faith and serve as a servant of Christ where he was. I don't think it was a rejection so much of the past as it was an embracing of the person that he found God bringing him to be.
And Connor, then, what about the time at Oxford then? Because it's there that he really seems to have flourished as a writer and grew in confidence. The friendship with J.R.R. Tolkien seems to have been hugely important. He later wrote that growing up, he had been warned never to trust a papist, and going to Oxford, he'd been warned never to trust a philologist, and that Tolkien was both. And they seems to have developed quite a good relationship that I suppose helped both of them as writers.
I think so. It's funny how often in art you get little pockets and circles that all work together and flourish as a group. And I think that there's a case to be made that they definitely positively influence one another. And you know, when I'm reading the books, especially these days when I'm sort of trying to see what works and what doesn't work, I'm struck by the similarity of style, in particular the voice in which their novels are written. They're both omniscient voices, like a narrator who knows everything. In Tolkien's, the omniscient narrator is very gentle and very much in the background. In Lewis, which is more appropriate for younger readers, the narrator is in the foreground and actually says things like, you might not like this, or he talks about our side, the Narnians. So there's almost a character telling the stories. But I think that they're both evolved somewhat conservative by modernist standards techniques, but very effective ones for immersing us into the stories. And so long as you trust the narrator and you're willing to trust the judgment of the narrator, you're fully involved in these books. But that does beg a question in Lewis's case, because sometimes the narrator's judgments are the judgments of a white Christian male, and that does show. I never noticed this as a child. I absolutely was immersed in the books, didn't even notice this going on. But now when I come to reread them, I don't quite get the same pleasure, because when I stumble into phrases that are alarmingly close to racism or And at times where this is a huge issue, which I'm sure the listeners all have opinions on. I've been going around ever since I was asked to come on the show. I've been going around asking my friends, did Lewis's theology spoil those books in any way for you? And most of them say, no, they didn't. I didn't notice it. It's not too intrusive. But for me, there are one or two moments where they do intrude. So Lewis and Tolkien in particular, I think, are the strongest writers of that group. They are both brilliant writers, wonderfully imaginative, and very capable of integrating their knowledge of human history and Norse culture to create fantastic worlds that seem believable.
And Connor, what about, I suppose, listeners will be more familiar with the Chronicles of Narnia, but I was reading that he also did a trilogy called the Space Trilogy. Was that the area of science fiction and fantasy?
It was, science fiction, yeah. And to my mind, in a way, they're more successful. I mean, they're not as good books, but, you know, it's fair to write a book where you're strongly committed to exploring a theme in its purest form. So if Lewis wants to write as he does, what would it be like to be there when the devil is trying to seduce Eve? Well, that's a fantastic question. And he locates it on Venus, which he makes paradise. And he has his character Ransom, who's, Bruce would be able to tell us more about this, but I hear that Ransom is somewhat based on Tolkien. I'd be interested in Bruce confirming that or not. But Ransom is there, so he's witnessing the devil trying to seduce Eve, and he's, in his own feeble human way, he's trying to stick up for Eve and save paradise. And it's a really good scene, and there's nothing wrong with a theologian attempting to write works of art in this way. They could be very, very successful. In the same way, you wouldn't criticise Orwell for putting politics into his book. You wouldn't say, tone it down, George. If that's what the writer's doing, that's fine. I think that the difficulty with the children's books is he's writing fantasy where it's not the same kind of explicit investigation of Christianity. And so when rather strong Christian themes such as Aslan's self-sacrifice come in, They can come in a bit heavy-handed.
Okay, what about that, Bruce, the Space Trilogy and the way he was able to bring not only the devil and Eve into it, but also his great friend Tolkien?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think Ransom is a philologist. Of course, his name is very significant, too, as an allusion to, obviously a Christian image of someone giving their life or exchanging their life for another. The Space Trilogy was Lewis's first attempt, other than his own, confessed even by him to be kind of a failure of a early autobiography called The Pilgrim's Regress, which he wrote almost immediately after his conversion, or reconversion, we might say. Lewis wrote a letter to a sister, Penelope, with whom he had a kind of lifelong correspondence, and he said of Out of the Silent Planet, the first in his series, any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under cover of romance without their knowing it. And this is not so much a reference to some devious plot on Lewis's consideration, but really a kind of reflection of what he thought the reading public had fallen into culturally, in other words, lacking a kind of biblical literacy. And so when he puts perfectly obvious biblical themes and characters into his stories, he notices that most of the reviewers don't even know that that he's plagiarizing the Bible, so to speak. And I think that's true certainly of Paralandra and That Hideous Strength. And That Hideous Strength is probably his most what might call overbearing thematic content, which is kind of based upon a series of lectures that Lewis gave, collected under the title The Abolition of Man, which he's very critical of what he calls scientism and society that's sort of leaking its trust in objective value and so forth. But I think Lewis from the start is pretty upfront, explicit about what he's trying to inculcate in his fiction. And I think with the Narnian Chronicles, I think he is successful with one group or another dependent upon how well disguised his prose is to them in terms of Christian conviction. Because I've had students over the years who've read Narnian tales all their lives and learned first from me in my classroom that Lewis was a Christian. So it's kind of an interesting paradox that he's often accused of being overbearing in his Narnian Chronicles, but I find him much more so in the space trilogy.
Okay, well, there are themes that we're going to return to again later in the show. Certainly, I find, and even in the movie version, especially, it comes very clear when Aslan, voiced by the Northern Irish actor, that's gone. The one that was in Taken. Liam Neeson, of course. How could I have forgot that? Okay. Well, we'll get to that. Of course, we'll tease out those themes later in the show. Paddy Whack Kennedy from County Clare was on to ask, was C.S. Lewis an officer, or what regiment was he in, and did he get mentioned in dispatches? Well, I've been looking at the Dictionary of Irish Biography, the Royal Irish Academy's 9-volume DIB, and there's an excellent entry on Lewis there by Patrick Maugham, and he writes how on the 25th of September 1917, Lewis became a second lieutenant, or lieutenant, in the 3rd Somerset Light Infantry, and went to France on the 17th of November, and then he was hospitalised with trench fever in February 1918, and then he was wounded in the leg, arm and chest by shrapnel at the Battle of Arras on the 15th of April, and spent the rest of the war as a convalescent, and his friend Paddy Moore died in action on the 24th of March. So information there, and of course you'll find it elsewhere. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking to Father Pat Rogers about how good or how successful C.S. Lewis was as a lay theologian, and we'll be also returning to those themes of Christianity and overt Christianity in the works after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan.
Thanks to IrishNewspaperArchives.com. History online and in your library.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History on News Talk. Tonight we're looking at the life and legacy of C.S. Lewis. We were talking just before the break about his involvement in the First World War and how he was wounded. Of course, today is Remembrance Sunday. And I was reading earlier that our new president, seems strange even saying the words President Higgins. We're so used to Mary McAleese. But President Higgins had his first public engagement today, and he laid a wreath at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. And I'm glad to see that Michael D survived the election, survived the jinx of Talking History, because he appeared on it just before the campaign started. And usually whenever we have candidates for various elections on the show, they tend not to win, but Michael D Higgins broke the Talking History jinx there. Okay, just before we went on air, I talked to Father Pat Rogers, who's a biblical theologian with an interest in literature. He also leads pilgrimages to Camino de Santiago. And I began by asking him how good a lay theologian was C.S. Lewis.
I think that for his time, he was remarkably convincing in that he had the basic Christian doctrine to which he returned after. You know, of course, that he went through an atheist phase. He denied the existence of God in his late teens. He was in Malvern College, and it had a huge influence upon his intellectual development, and he remained an atheist until about the age of 30, when, under the influence of his friend Tolkien, the famous Lord of the Rings man, Tolkien was a devoted Catholic all his life, but also an Oxford academic and a literary man, and they were very good friends. So after a series of discussions with Tolkien, Lewis began to reconsider the question of God. Now, his main problem with the existence of God had always been how to reconcile belief in a good God with all the evils he saw in the world. He obviously, like all of his generation, he was deeply marked by the First World War. The fact that so many people died, people whom he would have known were idealistic, who died terrible deaths, and that was a terrible difficulty. How could you, theodicy as it's called, and in fact I think that theodicy remained a big part of his Christian thinking for the rest of his life. He wrote a book called The Problem of Pain, in which he wrestles with it, but he had great difficulty even later on, after he'd become a convert, in accepting the death of his great, the great love of his life, Joy Gresham. He said it was one thing to be reconciled with the idea of grief and loss. It's another thing when it strikes you personally. And so he wrote this book, A Grief Observed, which is a most remarkably candid expression of a person varying between belief and unbelief. I think it was the fact that he was so candid so honest in seeing the arguments against his position that made him so convincing for those who liked his writing.
And what about some of the other books then? He wrote a partial memoir in 1955, Surprised by Joy, and he teases out some of the issues in that.
Yes, I think Surprised by Joy is very much a partial memoir because it's kind of recollections of his childhood, of his early life anyway, in which he focuses on this strange, elusive thing that he calls joy. Now, his definition of joy is not the same as the average person with just a moment of elation. He's thinking of something that has overtones of the supernatural. He had, in his early childhood, his reading included a lot of these Norse legends, and he had a kind of a mythic sense of that there's something beyond this flesh and blood life, and his intimations of divinity, in a way, I think, is what he meant by joy. And he said, you cannot force it. It sometimes comes and it often goes. It has nothing to do with the great love of his life, Joy Gresham, although later on his friend said how remarkable that he should have written a book called Surprised by Joy when he was in so many ways really surprised by her. She brought out dimensions that he had neglected in himself.
And how important then are the Screwtape Letters, and I suppose how relevant are they to a modern reader?
Well, the Screwtape Letters are a remarkable piece of leap of the imagination, a correspondence between devils, an apprentice devil who's learning the trade of tempting a human being whom Lewis very amusingly refers to always as the patient. Whereas the doctor is trying to cure the patient, Wormwood, who's the tempting young devil, his task is to lead the patient into hell. And he's been directed by his wily old uncle, Screwtape. And it's the series of letters from Screwtape. You get Wormwood's point of view only in Screwtape's response to it. They're all Screwtape's letters in the book. But it's a study of the many things that a careful moral philosopher would see, the many mixed motives we have, the weaknesses which we don't recognize as weaknesses. And sometimes, he says, the grosser temptations are not the ones that will draw a person away from God, but simply the focus on the ordinariness of life, focus on only sociology, focus only on science, and draw the patient away from thinking about the possibility that there is a greater something above and beyond. So Screwtape's letters are a kind of examination of conscience for, we'd say, a careful person who wants to see what real spirituality might be about. I think it reads even today now. I was reading it recently, and it's not at all as old-fashioned as its date of publication would suggest.
And C.S. Lewis is largely remembered for The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the whole Chronicles of Narnia series. And even there's the criticism is that it's too much of a Christian allegory and that he's allowed his religion to influence his writings. How would you view that debate?
I would say that's probably true. He has definitely a moral purpose, but it's more than moral. I think he's trying to suggest a sense of wonder, precisely that which Screwtape is trying to take away from people, the sense of wonder, the sense that there is something beyond the here and the now. It's been very popular with children since. It's actually he had no children himself, but he had a great interest in entertaining children and, if possible, offering them something worthwhile. And I think it's still a popular book and has been made into quite a useful film.
So to summarise then, how would you see him then as a theologian? Was he very much a product of his time, wrestling with the kinds of issues that were very much the preoccupations of the time? Or is there still much of value there that people can return to the same way, say, you've been returning to the Screwtape Letters?
Well, I personally, I wouldn't call him a theologian. I don't think that's what he was. He was a literary man with theological interest. And so, as a lay theologian, he was superb. He was also very interested in and willing to give talks to various groups on matters of morality. His talks during the war, the Second War, were apparently of great help to many people in Britain. He was very much in demand, a very engaging lecturer. He was trying to put flesh and blood, ordinary words. I think in that way he was very much more accessible than many professional theologians.
Okay.
Now, you never asked me about the fact that one of my ways of doing theology is to bring people on the Camino de Santiago, and I have a big one organised for next May. You'll find it on camino.ie.
And would C.S. Lewis have enjoyed that walk?
I think I would very much enjoy his company or somebody like him. The range of what he was interested in would have made him a very engaging companion.
Okay, Father Pat Rogers, biblical theologian and someone who has a huge interest in literature as well, and someone who is very good at marketing his walking tours and the Camino de Santiago pathway. And you can find much more about that on, well, I suppose by calling the agency there, 0818 878 3116. And we'll be back with more Talking History and more about C.S. Lewis after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan.
Thanks to IrishNewspaperArchives.com. History online and in your library.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life and work of C.S. Lewis. I'm joined by Professor Bruce L. Edwards, Jude Collins and Dr. Connor Costick. But Jude, can you talk to us maybe about the Chronicles of Narnia? Because that's, I suppose, what Lewis is most remembered for. What was it about those books that made them so, I suppose, popular in his lifetime, but I suppose so enduringly popular ever since?
Well, Patrick, a reason for the success of the Narnia, beyond the success, say, of the science trilogy, we're talking about the science fiction trilogy, is that with the Narnia series, he had evacuees from London staying with him. And I think he began to tell stories to them. And out of that came the Narnia Chronicles. He says himself, for example, that the character of Aslan, who represents Christ, but that didn't come into the story. He says it came bounding into the story after he'd been embarked on the story for some time, and that he'd been dreaming about lions at the time, and he didn't know what it meant. And then it came into the story, and then it began to pull together all the strands. So he discovered, if you like, the theology in his story, rather than setting out to, if you like, create a world that would exemplify theology. And I think that's why the science fiction stories aren't as convincing, is that he set out to tell us about a world, how the world would have looked like if Eve had resisted temptation, for example. So he had, if you like, a purpose, a practical purpose, and he then created a story around that. With the Narnia series, it's the other way around. He's starting to write a story, and out of that begins to emerge these Christian allegories, although he denies that they were allegories. I think they succeeded really because they were just good, ripping yarns. They were stuff, I know when I read them to my children, they were things that an adult could enjoy as well as the children themselves. And I think the best children's books work at that in that way. They work at a level that the adult can enjoy and at a level that children can enjoy. My children never asked me, what does this mean? They accepted the magic of the thing, and they liked talking horses, and they liked lions that came bounding on and, give orders or told the children what to do. They like the great clash of great forces and the magic of it all. But the Christianity of it, the Christian message of it, really didn't arise as far as they were concerned. And I think that's what makes it successful. C.S. Lewis at one point said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So I think he was setting out to tell a story. And because he was a Christian, the Christian themes began to emerge from it in the Narnia series. I think it was the other way around in the science fiction trilogy.
And Bruce, Jude has shown us there the universal appeal of the novels, but you've done such extensive work on the Narnia series, and especially The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. What other insights should we bring to bear on this series?
Well, I think something his friend of more than 40 years, Owen Barfield, who himself lived to be 99, something he said about Lewis, I think, accounts for some of Lewis's enduring appeal, and it was this. Somehow what Lewis thought about everything was secretly present in what he said about anything. Very integrated intellect, imagination, heart, and I think that this is true of everything Lewis writes after his conversion, but it's especially true of the Seven Narnian Chronicles. And I think we can't underestimate the influence that Tolkien also had, not in terms of the themes in writing. In fact, Tolkien did not like the Narnian Chronicles very much, but they both talked to each other about the stories they liked to read as children. And there's a lot of E. Nesbitt and Beatrix Potter and the Water Babies coming out in Narnia. And just as Jude said, I think the appeal of the talking animals, the kind of ridiculous mixed mythology of Father Christmas coming in to the first story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lewis, although Michael Ward has written a really interesting book about Lewis using astrological themes as motivations and so forth, I still tend to think that there's a lot in Lewis that he just likes to pick and choose among a lot of different mythologies of his youth, and rediscovered toward the end of his life as he's starting to turn to fiction more than apologetics. And I think that the whimsy as well as the appeal of Aslan as the ultimate hero, I think this just continues to amaze and enthrall readers all over the world, by the way, not just in the English-speaking world, but new sets of readers in China, India, South America. No end in sight.
Okay, Connor, what about an answer to your own question that you've been posing all week, whether religion spoils the book? You gave us a bit of an answer before, but sometimes when you do read the Aslan sections or some of the other sections, it can be a little heavy.
Yeah, and I'm going to disagree with Jude, but I should preface my disagreement by saying clearly we share a love of the books, and I do think they're fantastic stories with wonderful characters. And yeah, if we've time, I'm happy to explain why I think they're very successful, rather than just focus on the less successful parts of it. But since you've put that question, and I think it's a fair question, which every reader asks of themselves. For me, the Christianity does not evolve naturally out of the stories. There's a very glaring and unnatural and jarring violence done to the plot of Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, which if you forgot about Christianity whatsoever, and you just picked up a book in which the central event was that the main character has to sacrifice his life, you'd want to know why was that sacrifice taking place. You'd want a very good reason why this deed has to be done. And we're not given one. I mean, the reason is that Edmund has eaten Turkish Delight that he shouldn't have. That's not a great reason for the whole plot of that book revolving around that misdemeanor. And in fact, when I went to reread much more attentively, what exactly is the reason? We're not given one. It's something to do with ancient laws, but it's deliberately left obscure because he's really forced the story into a channel that it hasn't naturally been headed for. And funnily enough, only now, just thinking about this discussion, I think those books might actually be better without Aslan, which is an extraordinary thing to say because he's so central. And I think
Aslan pulled them together. And certainly that was C.S. Lewis's own opinion that Aslan was the sort of the pivotal figure that makes sense of the whole thing. And do remember that for children, and I remember as a child myself, the idea of the lion as the king of the jungle, you know, the figure that's in charge of everything, the animal that's the king, that fits quite naturally into the notion of the king of the universe, you know?
It does fit naturally into the notion, but I don't know if it's that particularly appealing. If you think of great works of children's literature, or even fantasy, you've got a problem whenever you introduce an all-powerful safety father figure, which is that father figure can then crush the evolution of the individuals. Because if they're not all-powerful, then why should the individual child have to struggle?
Yeah.
And that's why Gandalf, is much more successful than Aslan.
But Aslan is shown as vulnerable, or he appears to be, and in fact he seems, when he gets in that horrific scene where he is, you know, he appears with his great mane shaved off, you know, it has that kind of cliffhanger quality for children, I think, particularly. They're saying, oh God, the lion is going to be killed, the lion has been humiliated. They don't say, this is an all-powerful lion, therefore he's safe, you know?
Bruce, I'll bring you in as an adjudicator here.
if I may, I think Edmund's treachery alone is not the reason for Aslan's death. It's the reason for the White Witch to declare him a traitor and therefore worthy of death. It's the whole redemption of Narnia. Narnia itself is, you know, in its 100th year of winter, and it's every creature in Narnia that's redeemed by Aslan, not just Edmund. And so, to me, Edmund is sort of the pivot of the story, and Aslan is responding to the plight of all Narnians, not only Edmund, and of course includes Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and all the ones who've been made statues and so forth. It may be too heavy of a plot to bear in one story, and that may be why when we get to the Magician's Nephew, more and more of the background is sort of filled in. I think Lewis had more than one story in him after the first one, and I think that's where the weight-bearing walls are provided to us by reading all seven.
And Connor, as the books go on, the connections between our world and their world disappear, that it becomes much more about stories told in... Well, they're just. But how do you feel the books improve as they go on the series?
For me, they do actually. Up until the last, which is awful. I'm sorry. I'm just rereading it now. And
the last battle.
Can I just say this? Right, this is the bad guys in the last battle, and they wear turbans. And he says, "Then the dark men came around them in a thick crowd, smelling of garlic and onions. Their white eyes flashing dreadfully in their brown faces. And the dwarves accuse these bad guys, the Calamines, of being darkies throughout the book, and it's just distasteful, frankly. But having said that, I absolutely love The Magician's Nephew, and it has this wonderful contrast where they get this wicked queen from the long, long line of wicked queens, the worst creature in the world, and then they bring her to London. So you've got this fantastic juxtaposition of someone who's used to power trying to boss around a modern urban society. The walk of the Prince Caspian through the land of the giants, one absolutely glorious scene. So his later books are fantastic, but flawed at the very end.
Okay, Bruce, we also have to talk about his relationship and marriage to Joy Gresham. Michael in Mayo has texted in about the movie Shadowlands, one of the biggest tearjerkers of all time, he says, and wants to know how accurate that movie is. Can you talk to us about that relationship? Because he seems to have married originally as it was a marriage of convenience on both sides, so she wouldn't be deported. And then when Joy developed cancer, it seems to have developed into a really deep love affair.
Well, I think it is a very deep love affair, and I think what the movie lacks is an appreciation for how much their mutual faith in God brought them together. I mean, anybody who's read enough about the story of Joy and her initial correspondence with Lewis is given much credit in Joy's correspondence with bringing her to a belief in God and a belief in Christianity. And personally, I think Shadowlands is a great melodramatic movie that just really doesn't happen to be about C.S. Lewis or Joy Davidman. There's so much in their lives and in Lewis's friendship that would be worthy screenplay, that it's kind of shocking to me that the movie would be made on the premises that it was.
What about that, Jude? Do you have any strong views on the movie or on that relationship?
Well, I would just again to quote C.S. Lewis himself, he says, "Eros will have naked bodies, friendship naked personalities." And I think certainly he was drawn to Joy intellectually, I think, more than he was physically. That's not to say that there wasn't a physical side to it, but I think he was a man of ideas. He was a man consumed. His great passions were not passions of the flesh, but they were passions of the intellect. And the ideas that gripped him were ideas that Joy could sympathize with and empathize with. So I think that was what bound them together, essentially, not to say that there wasn't a physical element to it. But, you see, I think sometimes today, maybe I'm just getting old, but sometimes today we try to push on to things what is the spirit of the age. And I think Lewis at one point warns us about this, to think of our own age as being, like all other ages, a passing age, which in future times will look old-fashioned and quaint, and people will wonder, why did we think that way? So sometimes, you were talking earlier on about You know, was he racist in the things that he says? Or did he give sufficient wit to the girl characters or the female characters? Well, actually, I think the girl characters in certainly the Narnia Chronicles are at least as strong and clever as the boys, maybe stronger even. But I think that it's like we do with, you know, in Huckleberry Finn, where in some schools in America they wouldn't put it on the syllabus because there's references in it to Huckleberry talking to about his friend Nigger Jim. That because that word is used, that somehow is wrong. That seems to me to be trying to press onto a creative work that was created in a different time and different age and judging it by our standards. That to me just simply doesn't make sense.
Well, Bruce, what about the writings that came out of then the death of Joy in 1960, especially A Grief Observed, because his writings, his meditations on death and grief were very powerful, and I suppose that's another aspect of his legacy.
Well, I think it's a very powerful work, and it's very well represented among readership and certainly on this side of the Atlantic. There's even a Denver indie rock group, Genetic Engines, that's written a song called A Grief Obscured that I think characterizes Lewis's tremendous sense of loss. But at the same time, because he's such a powerful writer, some drew the conclusion that he had lost his faith. And I think the end of Shadowlands, both the BBC version that had Joss Ackland in it and the Anthony Hopkins versions, do leave that impression. And I think Lewis had what we might say normal, extraordinary grief, but had an even more extraordinary way of expressing it in this book that was originally published anonymously. But certainly Lewis recovered his equilibrium as a believer, and if we need any testimony to that, his last book for publication, Letters to Malcolm, which is kind of an antidote to the Screwtape letters, is very affirmative about his faith and the longing he had still for heaven, where all these reunions would eventually take place.
And Bruce, he died on the same day as the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the 22nd of November, 1963. Did that mean that his death was maybe forgotten about in the global reaction to that news?
Well, it certainly tended to overshadow the death of a children's fantasist and great medieval scholar, but time will tell. If one has greater influence over the thinking and presence of mind and willingness to live as a citizen of the world that Lewis represents.
And Jude, that statue that they erected in East Belfast to C.S. Lewis, I think, is a great way of celebrating and commemorating his life and his work.
I think they're very keen, particularly in East Belfast, Protestant East Belfast, to embrace him as a writer, because there are so many what they would see as Catholic, although in fact people like George Bernard Shaw and John O'Casey are all Protestants, but certainly they make a great deal of him, and rightly so, because he was a great writer. Could I just come back for a second to that question about his faith being endangered by the loss of Joy? I think that Lewis's background as, if you like, an Ulster Protestant is part of his religious thinking, even when he becomes much more high church in his later years. He's very rigorous in his thinking. He has this famous, I think it's called Trilemma, where he talks about the existence of God. He says there's three possibilities: either Jesus really was God, or else Jesus was not God and was deliberately lying, or he wasn't God and he thought he was God. And he says in the case of the last one of those, that he was not God but thought he was, that would make him delusional and a madman. And if he was deliberately lying, he says, well, I can't see that. If we look at the Gospels, there's no sign of a man who lies. He seems to be devoted to the truth. So the only conclusion you can come to is that he was a God. It's that kind of plain, hard-knuckled, hard-headed thinking that I think has its roots in the kind of Ulster Protestant mentality. And I think some of that is showing at that point.
Okay, Bruce, for a final assessment then of his legacy, what would you see as the great achievements of C.S. Lewis?
Well, we haven't talked at all about his scholarship, which I think is still solid, and although it has been updated by other later scholars, I think there's a great heritage there, certainly in American graduate schools. People pay attention to his work in experiment and criticism, which is a kind of theology of reading. Probably the Narnian Chronicles will continue to be the lead on any biography or any reference to Lewis, and I think that's legitimate, that's fair. But we haven't talked and could barely find the time to even talk about the breadth and depth of Lewis at all. What kind of occasional writer he was. He was, to me, a kind of the original blogger, really writing about topics and his opinions that were very witty, very persuasive, just to yield.
Sorry, Jude, you would see him as right-wing.
Yes, sometimes quite right-wing. He has one, for example, an essay called, and I think he delivered it as a lecture, called Democratic Education. And in it he's saying the modern, he's writing in the 40s, the modern notion that you could have everybody good at something. What tosh that was. He really believed that what you needed to think about was education for democracy rather than democratic education. And education for democracy meant locating the best people and letting them have their head and letting those who are less talented know their place.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Conor Costick, the final word to you.
Fantastic writer. Should absolutely be celebrated, but warts and all.
Okay, well, that's a great note on which to end this discussion. My thanks to Professor Bruce L. Edwards. My thanks to Jude Collins. His website is www.judecollins.net. My thanks to Dr. Conor Costick, who's been shortlisted for the prestigious Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award for his work on children's literature. Also my thanks to Father Pat Rogers. That's our debate on C.S. Lewis. We'll be back after the news when we're remembering this Remembrance Sunday. We'll be talking about the Irish war dead buried in Glasnevin Cemetery and lots more besides.
Thanks for listening to this Newstalk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.